This is a podcast from The Times.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle issue 111, the first ever Bugle to have the same three numbers in it. One, one, and one. What a day. What a day. I'm Andy Zaltzman, and to be honest, I'm in London, and there's nothing any of you can do about that, so you're going to have to learn to live with it. And in New York City, it's the man who shares his personal comedic ethos with the slogan of the California State Maximum Security Prison, all killer, no filler. It's John the Human Bagel, Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. Andy, I was in Washington, D.C. yesterday to interview a senator for the show, and as I was walking around the basement corridors of the Senate, I walked past Tom Coburn, the extremely Republican senator from Oklahoma, who I would not have guessed was anything resembling a fan of mine, but who gave me the kind of disgusted look that you would usually reserved for giving a dog that was defecating in a church onto a sleeping kitten. Now, he's just to give you some background about Tom Coburn. He is the architect of one of my favourite hysterical quotes concerning abortion. He said, "I favour the death penalty for abortionists and other people who take life." Now, including, presumably, the executioners who administer the death penalty, who, under Coburn's system, must then themselves be killed for taking a life by someone who in turn must also face execution, and so on, as Coburn sets off a fatal chain reaction leading to a full death bonanza, eventually wiping out all human life on Earth to protect one hypothetical fetus. Also, I've not been in the Senate before, but one of the interesting features it has is that at the end of the corridor leading out onto the street, there's a hand sanitizer, so the senators can presumably clean themselves after having to touch their constituents. and probably vice versa. Why stop there? Why not have a man hosing a chemical spray on every American voter who dares to want to enter the people's house? Or just whack them with a cattle prod if they get too close?
Well, surely it's to protect the public, John. You know, these people have to coat their hands in some anti-Senate juice coating that hardens into a resin.
Yeah.
That means they can shake hands and high-five the public.
You might be right.
Yeah.
High and low-five, too. The low-five is very much on the table.
Is it, really? I mean, has that really come into American politics in recent years?
I think so.
Because I thought, didn't Lyndon Johnson try to ban it?
No, he just wanted to ban the single. He wanted to go low-five, low-five, chest bump, fist pound.
Right, okay. And that's why Vietnam went on for so long. So, 111, there have now been as many regular Bugles as Supreme Court judges in the history of the USA, John. So this episode is the Sonia Sotomayor of Bugles.
Wow.
So Republicans, you better tune out now. You'll only upset yourselves. And as always, a section of the Bugle is going straight in the bin. This week it's, as it's Bugle 111, 111, famously also known as Nelson, the number 111, because the cheeky little womanising fleet master was reputed to have had one eye, one arm and one leg. But he must have had some chat. Hope you want to find out if I've got only one of something else, lady. So there is this week a commemorative Horatio Nelson section in the bin, including myths about Nelson, including the fact that he, in fact, didn't have one leg. He had two, but he did once tie them together to see if he could still win naval battles whilst hopping around. He also lost his eye after losing a wager with Lord Nantwich. After Nantwich bet Nelson he couldn't tell the difference between a pickled onion and an eyeball in a blind tasting, he then fought the Battle of Copenhagen with a pickled onion in his eye socket. And which is the origin of why we have vinegar with fish and chips, John.
Oh, because, that's an interesting story.
Nelson was having his post-battle chips.
Okay.
And he was told the casualty figures, and he just wept a salt tear from one eye and a vinegar tear from the other. Also, he lost his arm at the Battle of the Nile, after he had to recover his famous hat from inside a crocodile, which he'd mistaken for a basketball hoop. And we ask, if Nelson had been born in 1976 instead of 1758, would he have been Alan MacArthur? And is there any truth in the recent suggestion by controversialist historian Clayton Crage that Nelson's famous signal sent just before his final battle at Trafalgar, just before it kicked off, in fact, the Battle of Trafalgar in 1805, the famous signal, "England expects that every man will do his duty," was merely the first line of a rhyming couplet that, had Nelson not died in battle, would have ended, "and get down and funky with some big old booty." We investigate that, plus a free gift. We're going to help you build your own audio HMS Victory, Nelson's flagship at Trafalgar. And today, the first sound effect in the audio victory is the mainmast creaking in the wind.
Top story this week, OMG, what the hell are the Catholic Church doing?
John, I'm going to have to stop you here. That is not the most important story this week. The most important story is that Britain has been destroyed by a volcano. This nation is under a sea of magma, John. We can't move. I'm recording this deep in a bunker underneath the Times offices in Wapping in a heat-proof tank, in case the lava flows from the volcano do submerge London. Last we heard, they were heading down the M1, got stuck in a bit of traffic there.
Wow.
But dark days, John. You're on the right side of the Atlantic. It's hard to see how anyone's going to survive.
I've got to say, when I woke up yesterday morning and turned on the news and saw headlines such as "Europe crippled by volcano," I was expecting something a little more than Heathrow Airport shutting down. I was expecting to see you, frozen in ash, Pompeii style, flipping the bird towards Iceland. But I've got to say, it was pretty amazing. Anyway, the picture's coming out of it. Let's make no bones about it, Andy. You are currently under volcano attack where you are. You're like Pierce Brosnan in the movie Dante's Peak. It's Andy versus the volcano. How is your fight going?
Well, it's going pretty well, John. I mean, as far as I can tell, the volcano is steering well clear of me, because although all the flights have been grounded in Britain, you know, I've looked in the sky and I can't see any volcano up there. There's supposed to be loads of volcano ash, but it was... I think it's heard about my reputation as a volcano fighter.
Right, that's probably true. It's mainly intimidation that you need.
Yeah, well, it's from that time that I went on a school trip to Naples and, basically turned Vesuvius inside out.
There was a British woman at the hotel I was staying at last night who was clearly supposed to be going home and who was whining into her phone at her husband in the UK saying, "Oh, I don't know why they've bloody cancelled it, something about volcanic ash." How jaded have you become? When volcanic ash interferes with the smooth running of your day, you cannot just shrug it off so dismissively. "Oh, I'm sorry that your pilot was not willing to fly through a volcanic cloud just to get you to London on time. I hope he's ashamed of himself." You can't be cynical about a volcano, Andy. Volcanoes are amazing.
But the problem is, John, you know, we've got a general election here coming up, as you know, in a few weeks' time, and none of the major parties have really said that they're going to ban volcanoes to stop this kind of incident crippling this nation again. You know, I think it's about time they address the real issues instead of talking about tax all the time. The entire population, actually, is heading for the high ground and sacrificing animals to the ancient Roman god Vulcan, just in case.
Well, Andy, I'm just glad that you're alive and you haven't had your ankles melted off. So let's go to the top story, the Catholic Church. And interestingly, the volcano is blowing towards Italy, Andy, and it could be that even the Earth's core is angry with the Vatican this week. It's the equivalent of spitting in its face. This is not an easy time to be a Catholic.
Interesting, because when they do the smoke thing, don't they? When the
yeah, exactly.
So maybe this volcano is basically saying resign, new resign,
pope. New pope, please. I think I've made my point. There really hasn't been a harder time to be a Catholic, Andy, since the Romans routinely used them as lion treats. Apparently they were delicious, tasted a bit of tuna. You can make a lion roll over and beg for one if you use them as a reward. Now, not that there's ever, honestly, really been a particularly easy time to be a Catholic. Their entire life is built upon a foundation of unremitting guilt. But usually that guilt is self-imposed and basically unnecessary. At least time they really have something to be guilty about. Although the new scandals need not test the faith in God of devout Catholics, their faith in their own church as an institution is in need of some serious structural repair over the last month. New documents have further linked the Pope to the massive cover-up of child abuse in the Catholic Church. This time his signature is on a letter denying the excommunication of a paedophile priest and asking for the good of the church to be taken into consideration before making any similar decisions. It's hard to know how to even approach reacting to news like this, Andy. You can put your head underwater in the bath and scream at the top of your lungs. You can set up an elaborate mechanism that results in a foam sledgehammer swinging from the ceiling and smashing you in the balls. You could even train a seal to slap you repeatedly across the face. But to be honest, none of it is going to make you feel any better. To put it in the mildest, most respectful terms possible, that is some low-grade poping, Andy. Low-grade!
Yeah, I mean, some senior Catholics have called for stronger action from the Pope, including sweeping reforms. Reforms that really address certain fundamental issues of Catholicism, including asking priests not to abuse children. But that seems to be a step too far, John.
But
a step too far.
Spare a thought for the many priests, in fact, the most priests, who have not been abusing children all this time. They have been betrayed too. In fact, feelings are running so high among priests that one US priest has even called for the Pope to resign. Now, obviously, the chances of this happening are absolutely zero. A Pope hasn't resigned since Celestine V, who resigned because he didn't really want to be Pope anymore. Nothing more complicated than that, just reaching the head of the Catholic Church, getting the job of being God's messenger upon earth and thinking, ah, not for me, this, not for me.
It's not the
turns out this isn't really my thing.
It's not the Bjorn Borg of
exactly. Exactly. Getting there was the important thing. Once you're there, it's boring. In fact, Celestine was later placed by the poet Dante behind one of his gates of hell. That's just what happens to someone who merely doesn't really want to be Pope anymore, let alone someone who was complicit in a child molestation scandal. Now, another reason the Pope will not be resigning is, of course, the Pope's infallible. He's physically incapable of doing anything wrong, even if he tries really hard, which this time he clearly has. Only God can fire the Pope, Andy, by killing him. It's the ultimate way to be sacked. I think the only consolation for people hungry for justice at the moment is that the Pope, as you alluded to, will probably not be able to win the next papal election. Unless Ratzinger stages one of the most spectacular come-from-behind victories of all time. Something about incumbents, Andy, that the Vatican notoriously hates. Well, elsewhere amongst Catholics, the reaction has been a mixture of horror, deep sadness, with some absolutely unforgivable batshit craziness thrown in there too. Bill O'Donoghue, Andy, went on Larry King last week. Larry King, who, incidentally, is getting his 8th divorce, it's been announced this week, which must make the Pope very angry indeed. Much angrier, it seems, than the systemic problems his church has. And Bill Donoghue said this. He said, "You've got to get your facts straight. I'm sorry if I'm the only one that's going to deal with facts tonight. So be it. The vast majority of the victims are post-pubescent. That's not paedophilia, buddy. That's homosexuality." Andy, I never thought it would be possible to say this sentence out loud, but you are making your child molestation scandal worse. The church is clearly going to have to make some rapid changes. Some argue they may need to take a serious look at their policy of enforcing celibacy on their priests, but again, that seems unlikely to happen. As Cardinal Bertone, the Vatican Secretary of State, said, many psychiatrists have demonstrated that there is no relationship between celibacy and paedophilia. But many others have demonstrated, I was told recently, that there is a relationship between homosexuality and paedophilia. F*** you! It's really not about Catholics, this, Andy. This is about some total arseholes who call themselves Catholic. What the f*** is wrong with them? They're just going to carry on doubling down on bigotry. Luckily, though, Andy, there is a good side to this. At least there's a glimmer of hope here, and that is that the Catholic Church have honourably been bold enough to enforce one major change: forgiving the Beatles. This week they announced in a press statement, "It's true, the Beatles took drugs, swept up by their success. They lived dissolute and uninhibited lives. They even said they were more famous than Jesus. But listening to their songs, all of this seems distant and meaningless. Their beautiful melodies, which change forever pop music and still give us emotions, live on like precious jewels. That's lovely. Now deal with your f***ing paedophile problem.
I think they're overrating it a bit as well, you know. It's not exactly Mozart. more of a Stones fan myself, but then I guess I'm Jewish. I know that...
Where's the link there, Andy? Where's the link there?
Well, I don't know. I know most... I mean, their whole first album is basically klezmer music with a little bluesy tinge. He's 83 today, the Pope, as we record.
Oh, happy birthday.
Doesn't look a day older than 30. And what a figure. Sorry, I'm thinking of James Bond actress Eva Green, who isn't a day over 30. She, in fact, she's 81 days under 30. My mistake. Anyway, happy birthday, big guy. I hope you got the new cassock you wanted with built-in wireless. Here's another Pope story, John, which, yep. Again, you know, I guess you can set alongside what we've been talking about. The mayor of a town in Malta has called for a sculpture near the main airport to be removed ahead of the Pope's visit to Malta because it is slightly phallic in shape. It's a sort of brightly coloured, painted column that, you know, does bear a resemblance to a wang. Let's be honest, albeit a slightly odd-shaped wang. But certainly, it's wangy.
Yeah.
If not 100% wang.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, you know, it's understandable that the mayor of this town in Malta, John Skembri, has asked for that thing to be... Because the last thing the Pope wants to be reminded of in the current climate is an inappropriate erect penis.
that's true.
Besides, well, you have to ask, why should he be offended by the penis, John? You know, surely that is all part of God's design. I guess the only thing that could offend him about it... In fact, it could be worse if it's covered up with a plastic sheath or something while he's there. I think that he would find it more offensive. And also, if, as you buglers continue to inform us, the Pope is offended by any phallic-looking object, he is never going to leave the house, basically. Just this week, someone sent us a photo of a piece of pavement, or sidewalk for you Americans, with some dotted white road markings adjacent to it that looked a bit like, how to put this without offending the lady buglers, a flustering crank hound. Now, there are buildings in every city in the world that we've been sent that might look rude to an easily offendable pontiff. Scandinavia dongles over Europe like a Flacidian membleur, and even the dome of his very own St. Peter's looks a bit like a woman's scrout. So ease up, Pope. If you're not going to be put out by the institutional abuse of children, Pope, I reckon you can cope with a cylindrical artwork that looks faintly like a man's proudly tumesterising Jillian. But it's not just Catholic priests, John, that have been in trouble this week. A priest in Sweden, manning a helpline, fell asleep whilst someone had called the helpline and was talking to him, saying that he wanted to commit suicide. The priest fell asleep and began snoring.
No. Please tell me you're making this up, Andy.
He fell asleep.
No.
But there's a happy ending to this story, John.
Because
the troubled man became so angry that the priest had fallen asleep that he gave up his suicide plans.
Well, there you go, then.
He said, it's not acceptable for a priest to fall asleep in the middle of a call. This should not happen when you call up in the search of help. I felt bad and wanted to kill myself, but I pulled myself together and made the call. I am very disappointed.
There you go. Now, hold on, Andy. Hold on, let's talk results here. That priest saved that man's life.
That's right.
So I'm not willing to criticise him here. The Lord moves in mysterious ways,
yeah.
Andy.
As do some of his servants, evidently.
Oh, dear.
Well, that was, I guess, you know, maybe just a way of putting it in perspective, you know. All right, you as well.
Library of Congress news now. And, Andy, the US Library of Congress, the 2 centuries-old repository of all human knowledge, has announced that it will archive the complete works of Twitter. The Fred Shapiro, the associate librarian, said this is an entirely new addition to the historical record, the second-by-second history of ordinary people. And apparently the Twitter archive will now join the very ambitious web capture project that they have there, which has assembled 167 terabytes of digital material, far more than, in fact, the text of the 21 million books in the library's collection. Basically, you know, a cross-section of pages from the web so far. Now, here's the thing, Andy. This is how I react to that. There's going to come a point when we, as a handful of generations, are going to have to make some very awkward decisions on what evidence of our behaviour we want committed to posterity. And we're facing that decision now, especially when it comes to the internet. And I'm jealous of past generations, Andy. They had it easy. That they could just let the complete works of Dostoevsky or Aristotle speak for them and shut their idiots up. They're just dead. Dead in the wind of history. Everyone talks about how great the ancient Greeks were. And yes, a whole bunch of them were clearly intellectual giants. But not all of them. Most of them alive at the time were probably total morons. Wittering on to each other all day about donkeys, about how to get the dust out of their togas, and how much they're looking forward to having a milk bath later. I resent being judged by future generations by the tweets of some 40-year-old Twilight fan with cheese doodle dust on their chin who spent an inordinate number of tweets informing the planet of their top 100 sandwiches.
Bugle feature section now, and election time! Well, it's getting closer and closer, John. The march of time is marching. And this week, well, it's been a huge week in the election, John.
Huge!
Easily the biggest week in history of the 2010 prime ministerial election. General election. I've become carried away first. This increased focus we have now on this sort of presidential style campaigning. We had the first of the prime ministerial debates last night. Which
the first ever.
The first ever.
Televised debate between three candidates, and even though they technically debate each other on TV in the House of Commons every week.
But the biggest, that was the biggest public discussion in Britain since Charles I and big old wart face himself, Oliver Cromwell, found themselves on opposite sides of the you shouldn't still have that head on the top of your neck debate in early 1649. But as you said, it was a momentous event in British political history. Right. And I think people surprisingly gave more of a shit about it than was expected, because it was basically anticipated that no one would give a shit about it. And in the end, some people did give a shit about it. So I think
I didn't see it. How was the how many people watched, do they know yet?
Oh, I don't know. Hang on, let me
It was 9.9 million.
Was it?
That's a lot.
And how many were still watching at the end?
There's no data for that.
Right.
9.9 so that million mean, started.
Does that mean no data or zero? the polls I was reading up this morning, Andy, the polls afterwards seem to suggest that Nick Clegg, the third party Liberal Democrat candidate, had performed very well by essentially standing back and saying, oh, what about this pair of arseholes, quite a lot.
That is basically, that's an accurate paraphrase. He was comfortably the best of the three candidates, which is, not, I guess it's like the tastiest of three budget hazelnut yogurts, I guess, in some respects.
I don't know why that... It's amazing. I feel like in some areas I've lost the capacity to be surprised by analogies and metaphors that you draw now. And that one I didn't see coming.
Right. Yeah.
Budget hazelnut yogurt.
Yeah.
That surprised me.
It was the name of a kind of skunk punk band I was in when I was a teenager.
I knew I'd heard it before.
And Cameron was a bit disappointing. He also made the closest. What everyone was waiting for was the first major gaffe. And there wasn't anything massive, but there was this one thing that might escalate over the years, assuming that Cameron wins the election. He said, are we really happy to say that we'd give up our independent nuclear deterrent when we don't know what's going to happen with Iran and we can't be certain of the future in China? Basically saying, we could easily have a nuclear war with China. Which, I guess, he's starting his bellicose rhetoric early, maybe trying to sort of show that he's an improvement on the current government who've just started unwinnable conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, and maybe he's looking at the next one, Britain to launch a nuclear strike on Beijing. David Miliband, the Foreign Secretary, said in a statement, to put China and Iran in the same bracket is an insult to a fellow permanent member of the UN Security Council and to a country with whom we have just announced a close strategic relationship. Cameron should withdraw this slur now. And, which, you know, I guess, you know, that the Chinese do sometimes, as politicians, their leadership does get a little bit tetchy about yep. things, as students could testify 20-odd years ago. And the Conservatives responded by saying, Mr Cameron was merely demonstrating the extent of uncertainties in the world, which, you know, I don't think they're quite that extensive. The debate, as these things generally are, was held under strict rules, just like in America. There's strict rules on the presidential debates, aren't there?
Yes.
I know they changed it for 2008, so they changed the rules. They said no blacks. they have changed that finally. But it's also in North Korea, there are strict rules that say that Kim Jong-il's opponent is not allowed to exist. And that these debates were controlled by 76 separate rules, John. These included that the three leaders were to shake hands at the end of the debate. And this led to some confusion, because it seemed that Gordon Brown misinterpreted this and had a cursory handshake with Clegg and Cameron, and then made a beeline for the audience and started frantically shaking hands with them, whilst Cameron held Clegg back by the shoulder from joining him with a look on his face that said, "Oh my God, what's he doing? He's going to kill us all." But it did look for one glorious moment that Gordon Brown might be about to try to body surf over the audience and out the back of the studio.
That would have been phenomenal.
Well, that could have won in the election, John.
Yeah.
Could you honestly bring yourself not to vote for a man who's prepared to body surf out of his out of a TV interview?
Well, that would be a great way to decide an election. Just have, you know, the electorate standing there in the room and just go for a stage dive. You know, if they catch you, you're Prime Minister. If you smash into the chairs, then... You didn't get it this year. Better luck next time.
Well, of course, it hasn't been done in British politics since Lloyd George body surfed out of the House of Commons to celebrate the end of World War One. So just time for the latest in the leader profiles of the political leaders in the build-up to the general election. And this week it's on the debate winner, Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg. And here are some Clegg facts. Nick Clegg studied archaeology and anthropology at university, so if he becomes Prime Minister, expect him to start scrabbling around on the ground, looking for old bits of pottery and ploughing billions of pounds of government money into seeing if he can make a monkey evolute into a traffic warden. Clegg's grandfather was Russian, so just like America recently elected a Muslim Kenyan extremist to be president, could Britain be about to elect a closet communist? Answer the question, Clegg, or should I say, Clegg? In Thursday's debate, John, he kept banging on about getting rid of the Trident nuclear deterrent because it was outdated and had been designed to flatten Moscow and St Petersburg in the 1970s. How obvious does he want to get, John? He might as well have just driven into the debate in a Soviet tank, said the first thing I'll do as Prime Minister is build a mausoleum for myself in Trafalgar Square. Clegg speaks five languages, maybe more. So why did he do the whole debate in English last night? What is he trying to hide? And recently declassified Kremlin papers have suggested that Clegg was in fact the man who dealt the fatal blow to Leon Trotsky's head in August 1940 with an ice pick branded with the Liberal Democrat Party's logo. And if that's not true, how come Trotsky was nowhere to be seen in the photos from Clegg's manifesto launched this week? Answer that. Clegg also, Nick Clegg, is the politician whose name most sounds like a memo that a forgetful burglar would leave to himself before attempting to break into a prosthetic limb factory. The only one who even comes close to Nick Clegg is the South Korean Minister for Juggling and Circus Entertainment, Tae Khan Ahn.
Oh, boy.
Next week's leader profile will be Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Your emails now, and, well, this is the most important email that we've received at the Bugle. It comes from O. Lloyd, who writes, "Dear the Bugle, I thought it was my duty to inform you of the refurbishment of the Florence Nightingale Museum."
Oh, boy.
"And it's reopening in May."
It might be refurbished, you're still barred, Andy.
"Please try and refrain your lascivious bodily urges when you make the inevitable pilgrimage to the museum."
Why do you think it had to get refurbished?
"They have probably freshly painted the walls or something."
Yeah, exactly.
"Looking at the plans on the website, it might be a test of your manly fortitude, however, as the new part of the museum includes three sensuously curving pavilions, inviting the visitor deeper still into the life, hopes and dreams, that paragon of nurturing red-hot passion. I direct you to the website so that you can see evidence of these frankly overdue changes. Be warned, gentlemen, It's pretty full on. Well, let's just have a quick look at this website.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
There's a great email here from Cambria. Subject line, octopuses and puppet theatres. Well, that's an intriguing start. Dear John and Andy, in order of closeness to appearance to my yellow lab. Sorry, Andy, you're more of a Basset hound.
Basset hound.
I was listening to the Bugle while folding my laundry this week and hit by sudden shock when you stated the new enemies of the Bugle. I nearly dropped what I was holding, the shirt that is my uniform for my volunteer job each week. You see, I volunteer at, can you guess, a small aquarium on the coast of California. There we have both octopuses and, yes, a puppet theatre. I rushed to get the story straight while the puppet theatre was unavailable for comment. I do have a report from our two-spot octopus, Clarence. I love the fact that he's called Clarence. So here's the quote. I'm not really sure what we did wrong, she said, looking rather dejected. I mean, sure, there's a few snobs who want HD, but all in all, we're pretty okay. Every species has their douchebags, right? I questioned her further on a possible feud between the Bugle and octopuses, and she just looked disappointed. We don't really want a fight. We're pretty happy with some shrimps to eat. That's all. That's all we need. I'd even share mine with John if he wanted some, I suppose. But, she continued, a sudden gleam in her eye, if this has to continue, I would like to remind John that we octopuses are more intelligent than house cats, have remarkably strong and manoeuvrable tentacles, have a bite like a bee sting or worse, and can camouflage against almost anything. Did I mention we can survive out of water for a while? Clarence is like an encyclopedia entry. So she goes on to say, there you are, John, watch out. These sneaky cephalopods could be climbing under your desk at work right now, waiting to ambush you when you get back. With the combination of octopuses and puppet theatres, I think it's safe to say both John and Andy should probably just stay away from aquariums for the foreseeable future. Brackets, though, I can get you in for free if you ever rinse Santa Barbara. That way, at least you won't break the bank while walking to your... That way, at least you won't break the bank in walking to your demise. Keep up the good work, guys, and stay away from any blotchy bits of wall. Cambria. Thank you. Excellent email.
Yeah, and there's a PS here. Chris, you might be interested in this. Chris, your brightness is a real refresher.
Yes.
And Clarence wants you to know she thinks you're doing a bang-up job.
Yes. Oh,
there you go.
So the octopuses are on your side.
Yeah, good.
At last,
I have a team.
Yeah, but not everyone's happy still. Sam from Manchester just writes, Chris stole my bike.
Yes, true.
Well, true. Okay, right, fair enough then. Okay.
Also, Andy, I think I received the nicest, almost sarcastic email I've ever been sent. Subject line, have the civility to read. Okay, beautiful use of the word civility there. So here it is. Dear Mr. John Oliver, my name is Abby Whitty, and I'm in love with you. Again, hard to say, Andy. Sarcastic or genuine. I've listened to every Bugle episode multiple times. I have all of your truly genius and humorous jokes memorised by heart, and nearly every night I drift to sleep listening to your lovely voice. Now it's starting to sound more sarcastic.
Yeah, I mean, that's only two jokes.
Basically, she goes on to say, I would like to extend an invitation for you to escort me to my junior prom. Yours truly and forever, Abby Whitty.
You're right.
But when and where, Andy? One of her friends also then emails... quite aggressively saying, you haven't responded to her. Well, I haven't had a chance yet. This is the first Bugle. And I haven't responded. This is my first chance to respond to Abby. I've never been to a prom, and the idea of going to one quite appeals, Andy. But no, it depends if it's a sarcastic invitation. I don't know how to take this. Right. I'm kind of thrown.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she started also, you know, bagging your current girlfriend as well. I mean, start trying to...
I glossed over that, Andy. I think I consciously glossed over that part of the email.
She said she's, in quotes, incredibly undeserving of your time.
Well, that's definitely useful to have in our next argument. To say, well, let me tell you, 16-year-old Abby Whitty thinks that you are incredibly undeserving of my time. What? Who? Oh, nothing. I've just got to go. Why are you dressed up in a fake fuchsia tuxedo? Because I'm going to the shop! And I'm going to have the greatest night of my life. Yeah, I mean, when? When is this prom?
I don't know. When is prom season?
I can break out my breakdancing moves. Actually, I guess, yeah, it won't be... it's probably not for, I guess, a couple of months.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm sure you can negotiate a pass for the evening.
Well, thank you very much, Abby.
Yeah.
I'm guessing I'm not going to be able to go, either time-wise or legal-wise, but I really do appreciate the invitation. Thank you very much.
Right. Say it like you mean it, John.
I do mean it, Andy. I do mean it. Don't say it like that. I can't take it. Can't risk any more angry emails from her friends. Thank you, Abby. Have a lovely prom.
So, thanks for your emails. Do keep them coming in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Bugle Sport now. Liverpool Football Club has been put up for sale.
Ugh.
Well, I mean, this is big news for you, John. As
big news for me, Andy. Yeah.
And
£250 million in debt.
Right.
Thank you very much, George Gillette and Tom Hicks.
Well,
thank you for your time.
Well, I think maybe there's a way we can deal with this, John, because we've seen the amazing generosity of buglers in donating almost £3,500 for sport relief.
Oh, my God, that would be a dream. If the buglers can take over the, the Liverpool Football Club. Hold on. If they take over, I can play.
Well, so all we're asking, buglers, now, all we're asking of you is to dig into your pockets for the sake of John Oliver, lifelong Liverpool supporter, to buy Liverpool from the crass American sports speculators Gillette and Hicks. And we're not asking for money up front. We just want you to say how much you would be prepared to give to enable John to fulfil his dream of owning and playing for Liverpool.
Oh, my God, that would be amazing. Just get me a game. Get me in the game. So I'm ready.
Just email your pledge, and don't forget it's football, so best to pledge several 100,000% more than you can afford. And I'll start the ball rolling by saying, John, I'm personally going to put up £50 million.
Thank you, Andy.
Here it is.
Thank you. I won't let you down.
I'm a bit short.
Okay.
I'll just get the rest off a bank. It's football. How could it possibly go wrong? It's a rock-solid commodity.
I won't let you down. I'm ready for this, Andy. I'm ready. I'm doing lunges now.
That's about it for this week's Bugle. Do keep your emails coming in, thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Just enough time for this week's Bugle forecast.
Mm-hmm.
What's it going to be this week?
Oh, you haven't thought you...
I always think of the forecast, John. You know, what do you want to forecast, mate?
Oh, OK, let's have a think.
Will anyone in Europe still be alive by this time next week?
Yeah, let's do that.
I can't see it.
Probably not, Andy. The volcano looks pretty angry.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it from here. I can literally see it. It's getting bigger and bigger. And, it's just magma and lava. The horror. It's like seeing Madonna live.
I wasn't aware that was a point of reference of yours, Andy.
It's not. It's not just those words just happened. I'd love it to be though. I'd love to see her alive or dead. As long as someone captures her.
On that note, have a lovely week, Buglers. Bye.
Bye.
This is a Times Online podcast. For more podcasts, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.